kind, disparaging laugh.
"Good grief," she says. "Can you put me on to Jake? Please?"
"Jake thinks the same," says Blue. "It's all we've talked about all weekend. He totally agrees with me. He..."
"Just put him on to me, please, Blue. Now."
She hears Blue tut, and then her son's voice saying,
"Hi, Mum."
"Jake," she says. "Seriously. Come on, what is this shit?"
"I don't know. It's just..."
"What, Jake? What is it?"
"I can't really explain it. It's what Blue said."
"Oh, come on, Jake. I know you better than that. You're not like her. That's not who you are. You don't have a sixth sense. You're the boy who never noticed when a girl liked you. The only member of the family who didn't notice when Granny Deirdre started losing her marbles. You've never been any good at reading people. So don't give me that. What the hell is going on?"
"Nothing, Mum. We've just got a bad vibe off him. Floyd or whatever he's called."
"No," she snaps. "Blue got a bad vibe off him. You just got whatever vibe Blue told you to get because you're her little lapdog." Jake falls silent, and Laurel holds her breath. She has never, in all the time that Jake and Blue have been together, expressed any disapproval of their dysfunctional dynamic.
"Mom,"
he starts. But he's whining, and Laurel cannot possibly listen to her adult son whining. Not now. Not when everything is going so well. Not when she's finally, finally happy.
"No, Jake. I'm sorry. I know she's your girlfriend and the center of your universe, and I know you really, really love her. She's your rock. I get that. But I have been sad for so long, and broken for so long, and finally I have something good. Something special. And I am not having you and your wacko girlfriend tell me that it's wrong. Dad liked him, and Hannah liked him, and that is more than enough for me."
"I'm sorry, Mum,"
says Jake. But she can still hear the whine in his voice, and she can't stand it. And so she says, in a very quiet voice,
"I'm going now, Jake. I'm going to hang up. Tell Blue that I know she means well, but that I don't want to hear any more of her outlandish theories."
She's shaking when she hangs up, and she feels nauseous. She grabs her wine glass and takes a huge gulp. She should phone Floyd back, but she can't. What would she say?
"Oh, my son's partner just told me that she thinks you've got a dark aura, and now I'm too upset to have jokey conversations about cardigans with you."
So she sits instead, and for an hour she slowly and deliberately works her way through her wine, until her hands have stopped shaking enough to send Floyd a text.
"Sorry about that. Jake had lots to say, and now I'm tired and heading for bed. I will be wearing grey jersey pajamas. They're relatively old. Smiley face."
His reply arrives a few seconds later. "That will give me plenty of food for thought to get me through the night. Sleep tight, my perfect girl. Speak tomorrow. Kiss." She turns off her phone, switches on the TV, finds something mindless to watch, and pours herself another glass of wine. For an hour at least, she coasts through oblivion, feeling sweet numbness spread over her like a heavy cloak. Then, when she feels nothing at all, she finally goes to bed.
"Oh," says Laurel, coming into the kitchen at Floyd's house the following evening. "Hi, SJ. I wasn't expecting to see you tonight."
SJ is standing at the sink, a pint glass of water in her hand.
"I'm not supposed to be here," she says. "Me and Mum had a big fight last night."
She shrugs, rests her left foot against her right foot,
and then the right against the left. She's wearing a black lace top with black joggers and scuffed silver tennis shoes. A constellation of hoops and drops glitters at her earlobes. She reminds Laurel of one of the fairies in a book she used to read to the children when they were small. The fairy was called Silver Mist, and had silver hair and silver lips, and was always dressed in black. It was a sad fairy, androgynous. It had secrets. Floyd comes in after Laurel and sighs.
To be fair, he says, as though Laurel had said something, it has been a very long time since Kate and SJ fell out.
We haven't fallen out, SJ snaps.
Well, had a fight, whatever.
What did you fight about?
Asks Laurel.
I mean, you don't have to tell me, obviously.
Sarah Jade casts her long-lashed gaze to the floor and says,
She doesn't like my new boyfriend.
Floyd makes a strange noise behind Laurel, and she turns to give him a questioning look.
He's 49, SJ says.
Floyd makes another noise and looks pointedly from Sarah Jade to Laurel and back again.
He's married, says Sarah Jade. Well, sort of married. In a long-term relationship.
Oh,
says Laurel, wishing she hadn't asked.
He has 4 children. The youngest is 8.
Oh,
says Laurel again. I've told her not to come here expecting validation or exemption from the usual rules of human decency.
No,
says Laurel.
No, I...
She tries and fails to find somewhere to bring her gaze to rest. And then SJ starts crying and runs from the room, her thin arms bunched together in front of her chest. Laurel looks from the door to Floyd and back again.
You can go after her if you like, he says to her slowly and calmly. I said all I've got to say on the subject.
Laurel looks away from Floyd and toward the hallway. SJ is brittle, like Hannah, but Hannah never cries. Sometimes Hannah looks like she might cry, but her eyes stay dry, and the opportunity to touch her, to hold her, to nurture her, eludes Laurel. So it is some long untapped maternal longing that sends her out of the kitchen and into the hall, where SJ is snatching her coat off the coat rack and sobbing uncontrollably.
Sarah, she starts. SJ, come into the living room with me. Come. We can talk.
What is there to talk about? She wails. I'm a bitch. I'm bad. There's nothing else to say.
Well, actually, says Laurel, that's not true.
She inhales.
Come and sit with me. Please.
SJ rehangs her coat and follows Laurel. In the living room, she curls herself into the armchair and looks at Laurel through wet eyelashes. Laurel sits opposite her.
I had an affair with a married man once, when I was very young.
SJ blinks.
To be fair, he didn't have any children, and he'd only been married for a year. We had an affair for 2 years. It was while I was at university.
Was it a teacher?
No, not a teacher, just a friend.
And then what happened? Did he leave her for you?
Laurel smiles.
No, he didn't. I left university and moved to London, and we thought we couldn't live without each other, and that we were going to have all these wildly romantic rendezvous in country hotels. Of course, within 6 weeks, it had totally fizzled out. Apparently, he and his wife split up that same year. Too young to get married, basically. We were all too young. Did you know that the parts of the brain involved in decision-making aren't fully developed until you're 25 years old?
SJ shrugs.
Who is it?
Laurel asks.
is the course leader, SJ says. At the art college, where I model. How long has it been going on for? SJ drops her chin into her chest and mumbles. A few months. And how often are you seeing him?
Most days, she says.
Where?
At work. In his office.
She shrugs.
Sometimes at his brother's place when he's out of town.
Does he ever take you anywhere? Drinks? Dinner? SJ shakes her head and plucks at the drawstring on her joggers. So it's just sex. SJ lifts her head quickly.
No,
she exclaims.
No, it's much more than that. We talk all the time. And he draws me. I'm his...
muse?
Yes. I'm his muse.
Laurel sighs. Cliché after cliché after cliché.
Sarah Jade,
she starts carefully. You are a very beautiful girl.
Huh.
You are very beautiful and very special. This man, what's his name?
Simon.
Simon has very good taste. He can clearly see quality when it crosses his path. And I'm sure he's a wonderful man.
He is, says SJ. He really is.
Of course. You wouldn't be with him if he wasn't. Has he said he'll leave his wife?
Partner.
Partner, wife, it doesn't matter. They have children.
They share a home.
Has he said he'll leave her for you? She shakes her head. Do you want him to? She nods, and then shakes it again.
No. Obviously. I mean, you know, his kids, especially the little one. And I've been through it myself. So I know what it feels like.
How old were you when your parents split up?
6, she says. Virtually the same age as Simon's son. So
you don't want him to leave her for you?
No. Only in an imaginary way where no one gets hurt.
But what if she finds out? His partner, what if she finds out? And then leaves him anyway?
She won't find out.
How do you know?
Because we're discreet.
SJ, this is the modern world. There is no privacy anymore. Everyone knows everything. All the time. I mean, look how quickly you Googled me after we met. Found out about Ellie. Someone, somewhere, will find out what's happening, and they might just tell Simon's partner, and then everything will be broken. Irreparably. And the only way you can avoid that happening is by walking away. Making it stop. SJ sniffs and ties knots in her drawstring. Do you love him?
Yes.
Do you love him enough to hurt a lot of people who don't deserve to be hurt?
How do you expect me to answer that?
It's a tough question. But you do need to answer it. Not now, but over the next hours and days. I'm going to tell you that in 10 years you'll look back and wonder what the hell you were thinking. Because I remember being 21 and thinking that my personality was a solid thing. That me was set in stone. That I would always feel what I felt and believe what I believed. But now I know that me is fluid and shape-changing. So whatever you're feeling now, it's temporary. But what will happen to that family, if they find out about their father's betrayal, will have repercussions forever. The damage will never heal. Fat tears coalesce in the rims of SJ's eyes and drop heavily onto her cheeks. Laurel thinks she sees her nod, but she's not quite sure.
Why did you and your husband split up?
Because of Ellie. because I didn't think he was hurting enough. Because he tried to make me believe that things would be okay. And I didn't want things to be okay.
Did it hurt your children when you split up? Do they hate you?
The question takes Laurel by surprise. Not, did they hate you? But do they hate you? She thinks of last night's awful phone call from Blue and Jake. She thinks of Hannah's refusal to engage with her on anything other than a very shallow level of human interaction, and the way both her children keep her at arm's length. She's always put it down to their responses to losing their sister when they were both at such a vulnerable age. She can't even remember how they reacted to Paul moving out. The separation was played out so slowly, it was hard to pinpoint the moment it had actually ended. She doesn't remember tearful recrimination. She doesn't remember her children hurting. Or, at least, hurting any more than they'd already been hurting. I don't know, she replies. Maybe. But then we were already a broken family. SJ nods. Then she unfurls her limbs, sits forward in her chair, and engages Laurel on a different level entirely.
I've been reading lots of stuff about it. About Ellie. On the internet.
Have you?
Yes. I mean, I was only a kid in 2005, so I'd never heard of Ellie Mac before. And now, well, it's sort of weird that you're here, in my dad's house, and that this hideous, terrible thing happened to you. A thing that just doesn't happen to people. And I keep thinking...
She pauses. Do you believe that she ran away? Laurel feels herself almost physically pushed backward by the unexpectedness of the question.
No, she says softly. No, I don't.
But then I'm her mother. I knew her. I knew what she wanted and where she was heading and what made her happy. And I know she wasn't stressed about her GCSEs. So no. Deep down, I don't believe she ran away. But I have to because the evidence is all there.
The burglary, you mean?
Yes, the burglary. Except I don't think of it as a burglary. She used her key. She just came home to collect some things. That's all.
But the bag. Don't you ever wonder about the bag?
The bag?
Yes. Ellie's rucksack? The one they found in the forest. Don't you think?
I don't know.
But surely after all those years on the run, she'd have had some different things in it. Not just the things she had when she ran away from home.
A chill runs through Laurel. She thinks of the hours she spent asking herself the same question at the time. Eventually, she'd made peace with the theory that Ellie had deliberately kept a bag with her things from home in it as a kind of security blanket, in the same way that Laurel had kept Ellie's bedroom untouched for most of the years that she was missing.
And you know, SJ continues, there's another thing. Something really strange about Poppy's mum.
She stops talking and they both turn at the sound of the door opening. It's Floyd. He's holding two mugs of tea and he throws Laurel a grateful look.
There you go,
he says, putting the mugs down on the table and then sitting down next to Laurel.
Medicinal tea. For frayed nerves. Everything okay?
Laurel touches Floyd's leg and says,
We've had a good chat.
Yes,
agrees Sarah Jade.
It's been a good chat. I'm going to think about things.
Laurel and Sarah Jade exchange a look. They have started a conversation that needs to be finished. But it will have to wait for another time. Chapter 25 The next morning, Laurel awakes late and full of unsettling dreams. It takes her a moment to place her surroundings. They've conflated themselves with something she dreamed about. But a second later, she remembers that she is in Floyd's bed, that it is Wednesday, that it is nearly 9, and that she really, really wants to go home. She showers and dresses and finds Floyd and Poppy at the breakfast table, reading the papers together.
"Good morning," says Floyd. "I didn't wake you. You looked so peaceful."
"Thank you. I must have needed it. Morning, Poppy."
"Morning, Laurel."
She's back in a classic Poppy outfit. Pink cords and a black polo neck, hair clipped back at both sides.
"Let me get you some breakfast," says Floyd, rising to his feet.
"You know, actually, I'm going to head home, I think, and let you two get on with your day. I need to catch up with myself before I head over to Hannah's."
Floyd sees her off from his door with a long kiss and a plan for her to come back that evening.
"I'll make you something delicious," he says. "Do you like veal?"
"I do like veal."
"Great," he says. "I'll see you later."
Laurel feels curiously relieved as she slides into her car and starts the engine. She'd thought that Floyd might try to guilt-trip her into staying longer, and was pleased when he didn't. Now she feels a sense of escape. The discovery that Poppy's mum used to teach Ellie maths, Hannah's comment about Ellie finding Noelle Donnelly creepy and weird, and her conversation last night with Sarah Jade, have all left her feeling shaky and full of holes. She needs to get home and breathe in her own space. And she needs to do something else. Something she hasn't done for a very, very long time. Laurel makes herself a mug of tea and takes it into the spare room. She sits on the edge of the bed and reaches down to pull a cardboard box toward her. Ellie's box. She remembers filing it in the old house. She'd been numb and drained and taken too long over it, a full day touching and caressing, holding and smelling. She'd read Ellie's diaries. They were sporadic things that leaped about over the years, making it hard to work out what she was writing about half the time, as she rarely dated the entries. Some of it Laurel had skipped over, and she'd thrown one notebook bodily away from herself at a reference to giving Theo a handjob. There'd been nothing in those diaries then. Nothing to indicate a secret life, a secret friend, unhappiness of any sort. She hadn't looked at them since. But she pulls some out now, flipping through them to find the entries written in the months before she disappeared. They were messy records. Doodles and cartoons, homework and revision notes here and there, dates and numbers and lists of things to buy on a trip to Oxford Street. Nice moisturizer, new trainers, not black or white, books, atonement, lovely bones, trainer socks, birthday card for Dad, smiley face. There were lipstick kisses and smudges of ink and glittery stickers, and, scattered in between, loose records of her days. And in those days and weeks before she ran away, there were only two things going on in Ellie's world. Theo and revision. Theo and revision. Theo and revision. Laurel peers closely at an entry from what seems to be January. Ellie is bemoaning her result in a maths test. A B plus. She'd wanted an A. Theo had got an A. Laurel sighs. Ellie had constantly aligned herself with Theo, as though he was the only benchmark that mattered.
"Ask Mum for a tutor," she wrote. "Fingers crossed she says yes. I am so shit at maths."
And there, a few entries later.
"Tutor came.
She's a bit weird, but a great teacher. A star, here I come." Laurel turns the pages faster and faster. She's looking for something, but she doesn't quite know what. Something to tie all the loose fragments of her dreams together with the reality of the last few days' revelations.
"Tutor today. I got 97% in the paper she sent me,"
She gave me a set of lip balms. So sweet.
Tutor, 5 p.m. She brought me a scented pen.
She's so sweet.
Tutor, 5 p.m. She said I'm the best student she's ever had.
But of course.
Tutor, 5 p.m.
Bit weird today. Asking me strange questions about what I want in life.
Think she's having a midlife crisis.
Tutor, 5 p.m.
100%. I literally just got 100%.
Tutor says I am a genius.
She is 100% right.
Tutor, 5 p.m. Think I'm over this now. She really freaks me out sometimes.
She's so intense. And she smells.
I'm going to ask Mum to cancel her. I can do this by myself. Don't need bunny boilers in my life. There's no more mention of the tutor after this entry. Ellie simply slots back into her life. She sees Theo. She studies. She looks forward to the summer. Nothing more. But Laurel's fingertip stays poised against the last entry. Against the words, bunny boiler. What does that mean? Her understanding of the term is a woman who stalks and torments a man who has discarded her, unable to deal with the rejection. Clearly that is not the definition that Ellie was alluding to here. So if not that, then what? Had Noelle been overly fixated on Ellie? Obsessed with her, maybe? Maybe even physically attracted to her? Has she tried to touch Ellie inappropriately? Or maybe she was jealous of her, of her youth and beauty and unquestionable intelligence. Maybe she belittled her and made her feel bad. And if any of these scenarios was the case, what did this mean? She squeezes her eyes tightly shut and her hands into fists. There's something in there, but she can't get to it. And what could it possibly be anyway? The darkness lifts after a moment, and life returns to its normal proportions. She slowly puts Ellie's books back into their box and slides it under the bed. Tell me more about Noelle, she says to Floyd that night over dinner. She sees a muscle in his cheek twitch, and there is a missed beat before he says, Oh, God, must I? Sorry. I know she's not your favorite person, but I'm curious. She rests her cutlery on her plate and picks up her wine glass. I looked at Ellie's old diaries today. I wanted to see what she wrote about Noelle. And she called her, I hope you won't be offended, but she called her a bunny boiler.
Huh. No, that about sums it up. She was a very needy woman. Very intense.
How did you meet her?
Ugh.
He swallows a mouthful of wine and puts down his glass.
Well, yeah, I don't come out of this too well, but she was a fan.
A fan? You have fans?
Well, maybe it would be fairer to call them fervent readers. Maths groupies? That kind of thing.
Well, I never, says Laurel, sitting back in her chair and appraising Floyd teasingly. I did not realize that I was facing such stiff competition.
Oh, don't worry. Those days are well and truly over. I had my moment in the sun with one book. My pay the bills book, as I call it. Maths for dummies, you could say. Except we weren't that honest about it. I got to be a bit playful with that book, and it got me a little fan club of slightly peculiar, maths-obsessed women. It wasn't my style at all. I soon went back to the big heavyweight tomes that no one with romantic yearnings would touch with a barge pole.
So, Noelle, she was one of your groupies?
Yeah, I suppose so. And I just split up with Sarah's mother, and I was lonely, and she was a bit crazy and a bit determined, and I let her have her way with me and then spent the next few years repenting at leisure. She was like a leech. I couldn't get shot of her. And then she got pregnant.
By you?
He sighs and casts his gaze over her shoulder. He doesn't answer her question.
I didn't even really find her that attractive. I was just trying to be nice, I suppose.
Laurel laughs dryly. She has never done anything just to be nice in her life. But she knows the type. Paul is the same. Will go against all his basest instincts and feelings to make someone else feel good for 5 minutes.
And then you were stuck with her?
Yeah, I was indeed.
He runs his fingertips around the bowl of his wine glass and looks uncharacteristically pensive.
Who ended it? Eventually.
That was me. And that was where the bunny boiler bit came into it. She wasn't prepared to let me go without a fight. There were some bad nights. Really bad nights. And then one day she just said she'd had enough. Dumped Poppy on my doorstep and disappeared off the face of the earth.
He shrugs.
Sad, really, he says. Really sad. Sad woman. Sad story. You know...
The mood of the evening has become somber and slightly uncomfortable.
I'm sorry, says Laurel. I didn't mean to make you feel sad. I just... It's an odd little connection, that's all. Between you and me. And Ellie. I just wanted to understand it a bit more.
He nods. I get that, he says. I totally get it. And of course it's Poppy I feel bad for, being abandoned like that. No child wants to feel that they weren't wanted, even if they don't care much for the abandoner, but...
He brightens slightly.
Now Poppy has you. And you are quite a tonic.
For us all.
Cheers.
He tilts his glass towards hers, and their glasses meet,
and so do their gazes.
She returns her focus to the meat on her plate, to the pink-grey flesh of the slayed baby calf. She cuts into it, and a rivulet of wine-coloured juices run across the plate. She finds she has lost her appetite, but she doesn't know why.
Chapter 26. The following day, Laurel parks her car in a multi-story car park in King's Cross, and heads to St. Martin's School of Art in Granary Square. Floyd had told her that SJ was working there today when she'd asked nonchalantly over breakfast. It's a bland day, newspaper grey, lifted by the Christmas lights and decorations in every window. Granary Square is wide and quiet as she approaches it, a scattering of pigeons across its surface, a few people braving the cold outside to smoke a cigarette with their morning coffee. At reception, she asks for Sarah Jade Virtue. She's told that Sarah is working until lunchtime, so she sits in the restaurant next door, and she eats a second breakfast, and drinks two coffees and a peppermint tea, before returning at 12:30, and waiting for her outside. Sarah Jade finally appears at 1:10. She's wearing a huge pink fake fur coat, and boots that look far too big for her. She starts when she sees Laurel.
Oh.
She says.
Hi.
Hi. Sorry for, you know, turning up unannounced. I was just... Are you hungry? Can I take you for lunch? SJ looks at her wrist and then up at the sky.
I was supposed to...
But she trails off.
Sure.
She says.
Fine. Thank you.
They go to the pub across the way. It's brand new with plate glass windows on every side, giving views all across the square and the canal. It's buzzing with business suits and students. They both order fish cakes and fizzy water and pick at the bread basket half-heartedly.
How are you? Says Laurel.
I'm okay.
How was work?
Yeah, it was okay. Bit cold.
Yes. I don't suppose this is a great time of year for nude modelling.
Life modelling.
Yes.
Sorry. How many students are there?
Drawing you?
About 12 today. But sometimes it can be 30 or 40.
And what do you think about?
All those hours in one position.
SJ shrugs.
Nothing really. Just what I need to do when I get home. Things I've done, places I've been. I do this thing sometimes, where I let my head just sort of bounce around from place to place. I find myself in places I haven't thought about in years, like a bar near my old college, or a restaurant in Prague I went to when I was 18, or a railway track I used to walk down when I visited my grandparents, and the smell of cow parsley there.
She tugs off a small piece of bread and puts it in her mouth.
Those birds, what are they called? Wood pigeons. That noise they make.
She smiles.
It's kind of fun.
And then you suddenly remember that you're naked in front of a group of strangers. SJ throws her a look of incomprehension. Her mouth opens as though trying to form a response, but then closes again. Laurel remembers what Poppy said about her being humorless.
So? Did you see him today? Simon?
SJ looks nervously from left to right and raises a hand, warningly.
Sorry,
says Laurel.
Indiscreet. And to be honest, not why I came here to see you. I just...
She recrosses her legs.
What we were talking about the other night? About Ellie?
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that.
It was a bit insensitive of me. I can be a bit like that.
No. Really, I didn't mind. I don't mind.
It's not anything I haven't thought about before. There's not one aspect of the whole thing I haven't thought about a million times already. I promise you. Including the rucksack.
But you were about to say something. The other night, something about Poppy's mum?
About Noelle.
SJ looks up at her through her thick eyelashes, and then down again.
Oh, yeah, she says.
So? Laurel encourages her.
What was it? What were you going to say?
Oh,
nothing much. Just that she was a bit strange. A bit freaky.
You know, Laurel says, I read Ellie's old diaries last night,
and she wrote about Poppy's mum. She called her a bunny boiler, and she also wrote that Noelle used to bring her gifts and call her her best student, and it all just struck me as a bit.
She struggles for the next thread of her commentary. Did you have much to do with her?
No, not really. I used to come and stay with Dad quite a lot when I was small, and sometimes she'd be here, but not always. And she acted like she hated me.
In what way?
Oh, you know, cutting remarks about my behaviour, that I was out of control, that in her family she'd have been belted black and blue for such cheek. And the minute my dad left the room, she'd just ignore me, act like I wasn't there. She called me the girl. You know, will the girl be there? When is the girl going home? That kind of thing. She was fucking vile.
Oh, Lord, how horrible.
You must have been horrified when she got pregnant.
I cried. I'm not surprised. They move apart for a moment to allow the waiter to put down their dishes. They thank him. And then they glance at each other, significantly.
How did you feel about Poppy when she was born?
Sarah Jade picks up her cutlery and slices through the middle of her fish cake. Steam blooms from it for a second or two. She puts the cutlery down again and shrugs.
It was... I don't know. Whatever. I was 12. She was a baby. But as she grew, became a little person, did you feel close to her?
I guess. Sort of. I didn't see her all that much at first because, well, basically because I didn't want to.
Oh, says Laurel. Was that because you were jealous?
No, she says firmly. No, I was too old to be jealous. I didn't want to see her because I didn't believe. I didn't believe she was real.
Laurel looks at her questioningly. It's hard to explain, but I thought she was like a robot baby or an alien baby. I didn't believe that Noelle had really given birth to her. I was scared of her, terrified of her.
Wow, says Laurel. That's a really strange reaction.
Yes, kind of freakish.
Why do you think you felt like that?
Sarah Jade picks up her knife and turns it between her fingertips.
There was a thing.
She begins, but then stops abruptly.
A thing? Yes. An event? A moment. And to this day, I don't know if I imagined it or not. I was kind of a weird kid.
She laughs wryly.
Still am. I do know that. I had a special assistant at school for a while because of emotional difficulties. I was prone to insane outbursts of anger. Tears sometimes. And this thing, it happened right at the height of all this. When things were peaking for me in so many ways. Puberty, hormones, social anxiety. I was still fucked up over my parents pissing up. All that shit. I wasn't a pretty sight. I wasn't an easy kid either. I was a total nightmare, to be honest. And right in the middle of all this, I thought I saw something.
She places the knife gently down on the table and looks straight at Laurel.
I looked through the door of my dad's bedroom when Noelle was about 8 months pregnant. I looked in and...
She stops, and her gaze drops to the table.
She was naked, and there was no bump. She was naked,
she repeats,
and there was no bump, and I don't know what I really saw. I've never been able to process it, never known if it was just me being a nutty little kid freaking out about a new baby or if it really happened. But when that baby was born 3 weeks later, I was terrified. I didn't see her until she was nearly one.
Laurel hasn't moved a muscle since SJ's pronouncement. Did you tell your dad? She shakes her head. Did you tell anyone?
I told my mum.
What did she say?
She told me to stop being a crazy person.
Where was the baby born?
I don't know. I never thought about it.
Laurel closes her eyes, and suddenly the face of Noelle Donnelly flashes to the forefront of her consciousness. Clear and precise, as if she'd seen her only yesterday.
Part 3 Chapter 27
So, it's my turn, is it? Okay, then.
Okay.
Shall we do it like an AA meeting?
My name is Noelle Donnelly, and I did something bad. I'm not about to make excuses, but I had a tough time growing up. Two horrible brothers above me. Two below. And a sister who died when she was only 8. My mother and father were unforgiving of the limitations of children. They believed that a child should be grown up in every way apart from the way of having an opinion you could call your own. Not that religious, which was strange for the times and the place. Church on a Sunday was a good opportunity to find out that everyone else's children were doing better than their own.
The Bible had some good quotes that could be used to sow a seed of terror, here and there. We all believed in hell and heaven, even if we believed in nothing else. And sex was something that only disgusting people did, married or not. We never asked after our own provenance. Imagined a kind of chaste communion across a brick wall somehow. Because they had separate bedrooms, my mother and father. Home was a 10-bedroom villa on a hill, sheep all around, a mile and a half to school, downhill going there, uphill coming back. My parents took in orphans sometimes, in emergencies. They'd arrive bleary-eyed in the small hours, huge sets of siblings that they housed in the dormitory room in the attic. We called it the orphan room, long after there'd been an orphan in it. So my parents can't have been all bad. But mainly, on the whole, yes, they were. We were known as the clever family. You know that family. We all know that family. Pianos all over the place. Books beyond belief. Grade A's or you had failed. That was all we ever talked of. Academic success. My father was a math teacher. My mother was a writer of books about medical history. We all went to the best schools and worked harder than everyone else and won all the awards and all the medals and all the scholarships and all the trophies going. I swear there was not a scrap of anything left for anyone else. Well, I was clever enough to keep up. There was no doubt about that. But I was at a disadvantage for being A, the middle child, B, a girl, and C, not the girl who had died. Michaela. That was who I was not. Michaela, who was bonnier than me and nicer than me and, yes, naturally, cleverer than me. And also much less alive than me. You'd think, wouldn't you, that that would make me all the more precious to my mother and father. Well, at least we still have our lovely Noel. But no. Michaela died of cancer. We all thought it was a cold. We were wrong. Anyway, that was me. The less bonny, less clever, less dead sister with the four horrible brothers and the mum and dad who judged more than they loved. I did okay. I got into Trinity. I got a degree in mathematics, a PhD in applied mathematics. I moved to London shortly after I graduated, and it was nice for a while just to be clever Noel, not just one of the Donnellys. I tried my hand in the financial sector, thinking that I'd quite like to be very rich and have a performance car and an apartment with a balcony. But it really wasn't me, and everyone there knew it wasn't me, and so I left before I'd earned enough money for a scooter, let alone a car. You know, when I look back at this time, I'm amazed by myself. I really am. I was so young and so appallingly unsophisticated, didn't know a soul. Yet there I was in the seething belly of the metropolis, had a room in a flat in Holland Park of all places. I had no idea then how high I was flying in that postcode. I thought everyone who came to London from Ireland lived in a road full of big wedding cake houses. I didn't know that Walthamstow existed. But I was cute, you know, looking back on it. Had model looks, almost, in that bare-faced, hollow-chested sort of way. All legs and tangled hair and huge watery eyes. No one ever told me I was pretty, though. Not once. I don't really know why. I took a job at a posh magazine for a while. I was in the finance department, and I was literally invisible for the full 3 years. Then I got made redundant, and I had to give up my little room in lovely Holland Park, say goodbye to the wide avenue with the organic butcher before anyone knew what organic even meant. The food shop that sold lobster bisque and tins. The park itself, with its orangery and its bars. And that was when I discovered that Walthamstow existed. E11 with its little brown houses and its tired laundrettes, shuttered cab offices and boarded-up buildings. I decided to retrain as a teacher. I don't know what possessed me. I'd already proved to myself that I had no presence, that I was unable to draw any attention to myself whatsoever. How, I thought, I'd be able to engage a class of 30 slack-jawed teenagers on the principles of algebra. I do not know. I qualified, but I never did teach my own class. I lost my nerve. It made me feel sick to my stomach just thinking about it. So at the age of 30, I placed an ad in my local paper and I began tutoring. I was very good at it, and all those smoothie-making mums spread the word, passed me around like a restaurant recommendation, and I made enough to move out of my little room in the little house in Walthamstow and buy myself a place in Stroud Green, where the houses were slightly bigger, but not much. And that was that. That was that for a long time. And, oh, did I mention? I was still a virgin at this point. No. Seriously. I was. I'd had a boyfriend for a while back in Ireland, from age 14 to 15. Tony. So I'd got all the kissing stuff out of the way. Thought the rest would come later. Well, it never did. And then I read in the Times Educational Supplement, TES, about a book. It was aimed at people who thought they couldn't do maths. And believe me, the world is full of people who think they can't do maths, which I have to try very hard to understand, because truly, I don't. How can people understand how to walk into a room full of people and find something to talk about, but they can't understand how numbers work? It makes no sense to me. Anyway, I can't remember the name of the book now. It might even have been called Bad at Maths. Yes, that's right, it was. Bad at Maths. I bought it and I read it. It opened my eyes to things I'd never thought about before. But more than that, it made me laugh. I wasn't one for reading books, generally, and I only read this because it was in the TES, and so I hadn't been expecting such humour in a book about maths. But there it was. Humour. Bags of it. And a photo on the inside cover of a lovely man with a smiling face and a thatch of dark hair. It was a photo of you. I'd never been a fan of anything much before I read your book. There were TV shows I enjoyed, Brookside being a particular favourite. I watched that up to the last episode. And I always perked up if Take That came on the radio, although, on the whole, I was more of a classical fan. And, of course, I'd had crushes across the years. Loads of them. But this was different. You were different. Do you remember the first time we met? I know you do. You were signing books on your publisher's stand at the education show at the NEC. I go every year. Tutoring is a lonely world, and you have to plug yourself into the mains every now and then and get a fix of what everyone else is getting. You can't be yesterday's flavour of the month when it comes to these North London mummies. You have to keep on top of things. But mainly I was there because I knew you were going to be there. I'd made an extra special effort. I had on a skirt and tights and a lipstick the colour of toffee apples that set fire to my hair and made my blue eyes shine. I was 41 years old. The autumn of my youth. Christ, virtually the winter. And yes, I was still a virgin. You sat on a high stool at a high table. A small pile of your books in front of you. There was no one there. No queue, only a small sign on the wall behind you that said, Author Floyd Dunn will be signing copies of his book, Bad at Maths, today, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. And next to it, a photo. That photo of you, the same one from inside your book that I'd stared at for so many hours. Memorizing the way your hair fell around your ears, the line your mouth made as it attempted a serious smile.
My eye went from the photo to you, and back to the photo. You were thinner than I'd imagined. I'd expected a little belly, maybe. I don't know why. Hello, he said of my approach, as though someone had just plugged you in and switched you on. Hello. You wouldn't have known how nervous I was. You wouldn't have guessed. I played it very, very cool. Hello, I replied, my hands tight around my dog-eared copy of your book. I have my own copy. Would you mind signing it for me? I pass it across to you and you smile, that smile you have. The one that makes your eyes into fireworks that go bang, bang, bang in my soul. Well, you said, that is a well-loved coffee. I could have told you I'd read it 30 times. I could have told you that your book made me laugh more in a week than I'd laughed in the year before I read it. I could have told you that I was completely in awe of you. But I wanted you to see me as an equal. So I simply said, it has been a very useful tool. I'm a math tutor. Well, you said, I am very glad to hear that. You took the book from me and held your pen over the title page. Shall I sign it to you? Yes, I said. Please. Noelle. Noelle, you said. That's a lovely name. Were you a Christmas baby? Yes. December the 24th. Best Christmas present ever, eh? No, I replied. Apparently not. Apparently, I ruined Christmas Day for everyone. You laughed then. I hadn't imagined a laugh for you. In your photo, you looked as if you might go so far as a chuckle, if tickled to the point of no return. But no, you had a proper laugh where your mouth opened wide, and your head tipped back on your neck, and a big thunderclap boom exploded from you. I liked it. Very much. You wrote something after my name. I wanted to see what it was, but I didn't want to look as though I cared. You're American, I said. To a certain extent, you said. And you're Irish. Yes, to the fullest possible extent. You liked my little joke, and you laughed again. It felt like someone massaging the inside of my stomach with velvet-gloved hands. Where are you from? Near Dublin, I replied. County Wicklow, where all the sheep live. You laughed for a third time, and I felt emboldened in a way I'd never felt before in my life. I looked behind me to check that a queue hadn't built as we talked, but I still had you all to myself. Are you here again tomorrow? I asked. No. No. They're putting me on a train back to London after this, which leaves in... Oh. He looked at your watch. Approximately 2 hours. I should probably be wrapping this up soon. Have you signed many books? Oh, yeah. Hundreds and hundreds. You clicked the lid back on your pen and gave me a sideways smile. Kidding, you said. About 20. Long way to come to sign 20 books. I tend to agree with you. You slid the pen into your jacket pocket and turned away from me, looking about for a person to whisk you away, no doubt. Well, I said, I'll let you get away. I hope you have a safe journey back to London. Whereabouts do you live? North London. Oh, I said, an Oscar-worthy moment of fakery. Snap! So do I. Oh, you said.
Whereabouts?
Stroud Green. Well, well, what a coincidence. Me, too.
What? You live in Stroud Green?
This I had not known. This I could never have believed to be possible.
Yes. Latimer Road, do you know it?
Yes, I said, joy virtually pouring out of my ears and my eyeballs and my nostrils.
Yes, I do know it. I'm just a few roads down from you.
Well, well, well. Maybe our paths will cross again then.
Yes,
I'd said, as though it would be no more than a fun coincidence if they did. Not the culmination of all my hopes and worldly dreams.
Maybe they will.
2 weeks later, they did.
Chapter 28.
To say that I'd been stalking you would be an overstatement.